Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Dirt Buzz. I'm your host, Dale Spangler. My guest on this episode is Robin Hartfield, a true veteran of the power sports industry, where he spent over 35 years in motorcycle industry media and marketing. Robin is currently managing editor and publisher of Dealer News Magazine, and in 2020 was elected to the MIC Board of Directors and is a self-proclaimed print dinosaur lost in a digital world. Robin Hartfield, welcome to the Dirt Buzz. What's going on in your world?
Just another day in paradise. Shipped a major issue out, and now I'm paying the price for all of that.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about that. So yeah, there's a little mix-up. People are trying to share an issue on the same date from 2 years ago, I understand.
The April issue 2 years ago, we announced the 100 most influential people in the industry as a spinoff of our original Top 100 Dealers program, which, I mean, it was all well-deserved and well-earned, and they are still influencers. But this April's focus was on women within the industry. Totally different subject. So when we've got guys bragging about their inclusion in the April issue in their guys, it sort of leads to some confusion.
Yeah, it's like the gift that keeps on giving. So the piece of content's picked itself back up again and evidently gone semi-viral.
Everything lives on forever in the internet, as I'm learning. But as you said in the introduction, I am a print dinosaur. Always will be. I'm going to be that last guy killing trees and paying postmen, if at all possible.
There's nothing wrong with that, you know. I mean, there's some publications out there that have been pretty successful in the last, you know, 3 to 5 years. You know, these niche publications like Meta, you know, Iron and Air. You know, what's your take on those? I know there were some, you know, some media outlets that kind of tried to go that route themselves, like Cycle World. And of course, we know what happened there. But I'm just curious what your thoughts are, having been around this industry for as long as you have. I'd just love to hear what your thoughts are on that.
I love to see it happen. But a leopard can't change its spots. And Cycle World was Cycle World. And they were at one point in time the world's number one motorcycle magazine based on subscriptions or ad revenue or any metrics you cared to use. But they couldn't out Meta. And a grassroots viral publication done by a handful of people living and breathing and bleeding it are always going to do a better job of capturing that core audience than a faceless corporate monolith like Bonnier can. It doesn't work. And that's not to say that Cycle World can't be the best version of Cycle World it possibly could, but it can't beat these guys that do this because it's a passion-based project, not because it's a revenue stream and one of 100 magazines in your portfolio.
No, that's a good point. And I also think there's always this element of, you know, these days, you know, our attention spans, like our patience, everything is, you know, shortened to where I think some of these media outlets potentially thought, you know, if we make it, they'll read it, you know? And I don't think that's necessarily the case. I think you have to put the time in, grind it out for a few years, build your audience, and then you kind of see the success story. And so I think sometimes some of these magazines that try and go that direction, maybe just necessarily don't have the patience and are willing to put in the time.
I think that's a function of just the internet and the delivery mechanism as much as anything else. But even in the old days, none of these magazines were overnight successes. When Joe Parker's launched Cycle World, I mean, he paid his dues and he assembled it and cut and pasted the issues up on his kitchen table and lived and breathed it for a number of years before it became a commercial and viable success. And you can't, well, with the internet, I guess you can jumpstart that process because anybody's website looks just as good as everybody else's, and how you develop your readership and stuff. You can go to a click farm and buy a bunch of bogus names so that on paper, yeah, you look just like everybody else out in the field, but that's not what a niche enthusiast magazine needs to be. And even back in the old days when I did car books or I did All About Beer, or any of these passion-driven publications, we knew our audience, and we didn't try to be anything more than we were. And if there was only 20,000 craft brewers in the nation, then that was our universe. We didn't go any bigger. And now, fast forward to Dealer News as a digital entity? Well, there's only so many dealers left standing in the United States. That's our core group of readers. We're not looking to be anything more or anything less than Dealer News.
Yeah, that's a good point about the, you know, knowing your audience, you know, having like a niche publication where you're not trying to be everything to everybody. And I think that's where I see sometimes these websites and magazines, they try and do everything, and it ends up being you're doing everything, but you're doing everything average instead of really focusing on one thing like you're talking about and kind of putting the extra work in and showing the passion. So, yeah, I mean, it's definitely been a huge paradigm shift in the last probably 10 years. But, you know, and you and I have talked about this numerous times, but, Dealer News seems like it's persevered, and it was cool to – it went away for a little while, but it's great to see it back. And I feel like you guys are really just kind of driving – that whole B2B aspect and just putting out some amazing content. Like in this issue, you know, I noticed the theme was, you know, you had No Fooling and then Shattering the Glass Ceiling issue, where you talk a lot about Women's History Month and, you know, a bunch of different people that, you know, there's that you draw attention to, Alyssa Clickinger and Shayna Texture and Kristen Domberger from Kometic. And, you know, there's just a lot of these women. So, kudos to you guys for evolving the magazine. And you guys aren't print anymore, but you're digital, but you know, you're putting this thing out every month consistently. So talk about that experience and, you know, what your goals are with the magazine now and just, your outlook going forward.
Truth be told, my goal is to return Dealer News to a monthly print magazine and send it out to a few old guys that enjoy it like I do. But the reality is that we have a new generation that doesn't know print magazines and doesn't care to know print magazines. So we have to have a delivery mechanism that reaches the future as well as the past. And we're learning it as we go. But our content on social media kills it. We have a much bigger audience there. But, you know, I have the obligatory silly cat video mixed in with the hard news story. So I don't like social media as a replacement for Dealer News. It's an augmentation of what we offer in the monthly magazine.
Yeah, you're kind of supplementing it, right?
Yeah. And until the last of the old guys like me dies off, we have to make our online experience feel like, you know, flipping the page and as close to paper content and breakdown and presentation as we possibly can make it to a print magazine. Whereas with these other channels, we don't have those restrictions. So a little bit of everything. But I will say the one thing that has translated really well is the ability to embed video directly into a story. So the cover dealer, Gail Wirth's interview, is recorded. If you don't have the time or you just don't want to flip through and look at it and read it, there's Gail telling her story in the video play box. So a picture's worth 1,000 words, video's worth 1,000,000.
Yeah. You know, I've noticed that more and more, there's just so many different ways to get content out there these days that it's like a lot of these larger brands and companies are literally just becoming content marketing machines because they're producing content for every platform, whether it's a podcast, they're making videos, they're doing blog posts. Some of them are even creating their own magazines. Like I think, you know, Tucker's still doing it. You know, I think you guys brought to light that, you know, Harley Davidson was going back to print with a magazine as well. So it's like in some ways you almost have to have your hands in a lot of different, you know, pots, you know, like different situations to cover all the different listening scenarios, whether or not that's feasible for a lot of companies. But I guess in a way, would you say you're working in that direction? You know, when you're talking about embedding videos and as the magazine evolves, you're going to have these different, do you see podcasts and other things being a big part of the going forward, what Dealer News is doing?
Yes, over my dead body, but it is happening whether I like it or not. With the video content between Mark Rogers' sales success, our dealer interviews, stuff I shoot at the track, and the fun stuff that we get to do, we're putting up 2 to 3, well, actually more than that, we're probably putting up 4 to 5 original videos. now each week that just gets back-ended at our YouTube channel. We don't promote our YouTube channel. We don't use it for anything other than a hosting platform to embed the video player box in the magazine. But all of a sudden, in the last year, we've gotten 165,000 views of our YouTube content. So it is a vital component of what we do. We haven't figured out a way to monetize it. We're just using it, again, as I said, as a way to augment that dealer news experience. But it is a necessary evil, and it is something that we have to pay attention to and focus on in the future. The e-blast, too. We do Wednesday's the dealer download that goes to every dealer in North America, roughly 14,000 rooftops that we've got. And then on Friday is the News Flash Friday. With the advent of COVID, we had to add an extra e-blast a week just because so much was happening and there was such a need for information, we couldn't help it. And then we have Tuesday, which only goes to our advertisers and the OEMs and the big distributors. So there's three e-blasts a week. There's daily social posts. There's 3 to 5 videos a week. Oh, and in our spare time, we crank out an 80 or 90 page magazine.
Yeah, just in your spare time. Yeah, it's overwhelming for me just trying to do this single podcast show, you know, by myself and thinking about all the different, you know, avenues of where I can promote it. And everybody's, you know, now people are adding video to podcasts, which to me is like the absolutely strangest thing. But then I've caught myself watching YouTube videos that are podcast clips. So, you know, strange things happen. And so I think everybody's probably in this cycle of, you know, I think I saw this graph one time that showed the demand for content like is just going up exponentially, but the resources to create that content is staying the same. And so same amount of budget, but you know, your audience and even the brand in some respect is expecting way more content. So I think we're all in this weird dilemma where I think in the next 3 to 5 years, it's really going to be even more changes coming. I don't know what your thoughts are on that, but,
Well, I would say that we had our hand forced by COVID. I mean, If you're stuck at home and now the work environment's changed, people are going to work from home in the future, even when we can open things back up. That has changed the dynamic. And now people's expectations of content and when they get it delivered to them and how they choose to use it, that's all, I mean, radically changed in the last 12 months. And nobody saw this coming. It's adapt or die. It's Darwinism at its finest. It's not the strongest of the species. It's the most adaptable of the species that survives.
Yep. And then you start throwing in all these, like, I think you kind of alluded to it a little bit earlier, but just talking about, you know, these analytics, you know, where it's just, to me, like, that's just the biggest nightmare of being a marketer these days is like, you have to be this analytics expert that somehow shows to upper management, you know, or boards that, look what we're doing. We're increasing. And it's like, in some cases, like it's just, for lack of a better, you know, way to describe it, it's just bullshit analytics. You know, like anybody can make, in some cases, data probably look the way they want it to. And so you've got that added pressure on top of creating the content that it's got to perform, you know, and you got to show a proof because everything's tracked these days. And so that's kind of a frustrating part too, that I've been reading a lot about that and how, you know, a lot of these ad agencies are, you know, in some cases where, you know, not even really portraying their data that, you know, for clients, you know, in an honest way, you know? And so it's definitely strange out there on the advertising front as much as it is on the content production front.
I will say that we're blessed being a trade only publication. I know my audience and I know our reach, so we don't have to pad the numbers or say that we're doing something that we're not. And we have complete transparency. We have our deck and it shows what the open rates are of everything that we do. Any back-end analytics you want to see, you can see it. But it's a case, and I won't say all agencies, but a lot of the agencies don't know, don't care, can't make the distinction between trade and consumer. They just have to have something that they can tack a marketing fee onto and move it up the board. Or they can say, oh, well, you only reach 14,000 people. That doesn't even reach our minimum threshold. It's like, yeah, but that's every dealer in North America. Every single transaction of every motorcycle when it was new went through one of these dealers. So can you just say your minimum threshold isn't met? You need to look at that as an agency before you just shut us down. So that's the fight that we fight when I'm wearing my publisher hat. Fortunately, I wear my editor hat more than I wear my publisher hat.
Yeah, I would not want to have to wear an ad salesman hat right now either. Like we were just talking about that subject. Yeah. I've never been a guy that's, you know, I don't feel good. I just am not comfortable calling up people that I consider in a lot of cases friends and asking for money. And so, yeah, but these days I can't imagine being, you know, selling like digital ads and stuff. It's got to be a pretty brutal job.
Used to be the hardest sell was radio. But now it's this digital entity, a digital magazine, a podcast, whatever it is. That is tough. There's smoke and mirrors because it is the Wild West. We don't have, a number of newsstand sales or a print run or anything. It's just content that goes out into cyberspace. So how do you monetize it and put a value to that? It does get tough.
Yeah. I feel like the whole digital ad industry right now, like it's just so like confusing. And I think that's even almost part of what the industry is trying to do in some respects, because every time someone starts to get things figured out, then things change again. Well, Google will change things or Facebook will change things.
Oh yeah.
And so it's just, it's definitely wild times for, you know, media these days and selling ads. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens. But in this current issue, just to kind of go back to the new dealer news that came out this morning, like I was saying, you had this, you know, this Women's History Month issue, and I read your intro piece in the issue, and what I really like what you said was like how, and I think it was Alyssa you were alluding to, Alyssa Clickinger, that, you know, challenging the played out biker stereotype, and that just really struck a chord with me. I'm like, it's so true. Like our industry in some ways needs that so much. And what better way to draw attention to it than, you know, in an issue filled with women and from different perspectives. And so tell me a little bit about that.
Well, that quote actually came from Emily from BRP.
Oh, okay. That's right.
And that's their outreach for the Outliers program and their Spider and Riker outreach. So it's a definite shift in direction from traditional OE marketing. But with that three-wheel platform, it's been anything but traditional. It's women, it's first-time riders, it's all sorts of the demographics that the standard two-wheel market's missed that BRP has capitalized. And I didn't even think about it, but it went from 100,000 the Spiders sold in the first 10 years to now it's almost 1 million units.
Oh, wow.
And I don't see a lot of them. I've the ones I've seen, I've been riding, but they're out there. And when I went to Sturgis a couple of times, I saw whole packs of them headed to Sturgis, which just blew my mind. So there is, just like the original outlaw bikers, there's now the outliers on the BRP three-wheel product. And that's its own community, its own dealer network, its own everything that has flown under the traditional radar.
Yeah, and that's a tough one because, you know, as much as, you know, we all want to celebrate success in power sports, sometimes we can be our own worst enemy and be a little bit, I don't know, I guess you'd say judgmental, you know, like having grown up racing motocross myself, you know, like there's that old, you know, quad riders versus dirt bike riders. There's like this weird animosity there, you know, or Harley guys versus dirt bike guys. And so now we're adding in these, you know, these BRP machines that are three wheels. And of course, right away, you know, like hardcore motorcyclists, probably people thinking, oh, Jesus, you know, and I might have probably done that too the first time I saw them. But then the big picture, it's a brand new demographic, like you're saying. So we're just going to bring more people to power sports, generate more interest.
But even an old dirt bike guy like you can eventually become understanding of everybody except maybe the quad guys. As we discussed in the beginning of the pandemic, we are all on this together, and it's brought us closer together. And it's also opened up the doors. So that's the weird part about the pandemic is it's actually been a boon for our industry.
Yeah.
It's now, if we don't screw up this recovery, the industry should be in pretty good shape for the next 5 to 10 years.
Yeah, that's true. And like companies like BRP and Polaris, they've done a really good job of really getting their names and power sports out in the public and some of these larger publications, you know, like Forbes and different magazines like that, business magazines. And so, like, as you said, yeah, it's drawing more attention to power sports. So, and I would kind of look at that as a good thing.
Absolutely. And then also in this issue, it's one of the news stories in the women's section, but there's a video component because it's over an hour long. And Mark Rogers gathered about five or six of the best women dealers that he knew and just did a panel discussion with them. And the great thing about it was not one of them thought of themselves as a woman within the industry. They just thought of themselves as people within the industry. They didn't make that distinction. But as they, all of the women said, hey, everybody's money's green. I just want to get you on two wheels. So they don't see themselves fighting a class war. And in fact, a couple of the women have said that their men customers are great because they're chivalrous and understanding and helpful, whereas some of their women customers aren't quite that good. But they all also agreed that they'd love to have more women staffers and a properly trained woman on their sales floor runs rings around the best of their old guy salesmen. And there's very few women techs. There's always a lack of techs anywhere. But women techs, I mean, that's a unicorn out there. So opportunities for our industry to become more inclusive, it's start with women techs. It's get women in the dealerships working at the dealership level, and also taking that mentality that the successful women have is, hey, don't play the woman card. Just go out there and kill it with your own talent.
Yep. Yeah, I think I saw this thing that I think was getting shared multiple times on LinkedIn. It was like, you know, in March, because March is, you know, Women's History Month. And so it was like, you know, I'm not a woman CEO, I'm a CEO, you know, and it's sort of like, and it made me stop. And it's just one of those light bulb moments where you're like, why do we always have to kind of qualify things, especially when it comes to gender sometimes. And so that was, I just thought that was kind of an interesting post. And it's sort of like what you're saying there, but it's, you know, like treat it like a, you know, ride like a girl or whatever. Like, well, that's getting turned into like a positive thing, you know? So it's like, you know, a lot of these old school stereotypes, yeah, and sayings are kind of just getting thrown by the wayside.
And that is again, courtesy of the pandemic and forcing us to reevaluate how we do business and who we do business with.
Yep. So let's talk a little bit. I'm going to change direction a little bit. I just want to know a little bit more about your career, because you've been doing this for, I want to say, I think I saw we're 37 years that you've been in the industry, somewhere around there.
Yeah, it's getting up there. It goes back in junior high. My writing buddy and I would sit there in our last class of the day, which was free reading. And we would pull out a sheet of paper at the beginning of the hour and do A to Z motorcycle OEMs.
That's cool.
And you couldn't repeat it, and you couldn't. And every day it was a different challenge and stuff. So we would do just silly stuff like that. I realized early on that I have no mechanical aptitude. I can't ride worth shit. There was no way for me to be a part of the industry that I loved, unless I just became the ultimate fan and became an editor by following along. So when I was in high school, I started as a stringer for a local off-road magazine. Basically, I supplied everything and got a byline once in a while, but hey, that's pretty cool at that point. And then by the time I got to college, I leveraged a couple of internships, became Off-Road Magazine's official ATV editor, actually ATC at that time, because we were still on three wheels. The four-wheelers hadn't even come out. But I rode the first quad that Suzuki came out with, and that whole era of when we went from two wheels to three to four. and had a front row seat and an editorship at a lot of different magazines from that point on. And then I decided I needed to grow up and get a real job, and that didn't work real well. So I went back to I'd always done consumer books and newsstand books. So I got an opportunity to go to work at Dealer News. I interviewed there in 89, and then they brought me back in 90 and asked what I could do for them. And at that time, it was February issue. It was a February show issue for Dealer Expo, and Motorcycle Industry Magazine and Motorcycle Product News and Dealer News all ran the same stock photo that Kawasaki supplied to the new KLR 650. And it's like, well, A, your name is Dealer News, so put a dealer on the cover. B, it's your cover shot. Don't use a canned photo. I mean, you're not a newsstand magazine, but don't treat it as a second-rate experience. And give these dealers a chance to be a hero in their own magazine. And, I mean, you might not make the cover of Time or Newsweek as a motorcycle dealer, but you can make the cover of Dealer News. And that philosophy now has continued on since 1990 when we first launched it up until today with the release of the issue with Gail Wirth on the cover.
Yep. And then what I noticed too that for a little while you went over to Dealer News competitor, Motorcycle Power Sports News, and then went back to Dealer News. So yeah, I mean, you've been in some cool places. And of course my favorite, All About Beer, you know, I mean, you got to tell me about that. And then VW Trends. I'm like, what? Talk about some.
And VW Trends is coming back and coming
what?
Back as a print magazine.
No way.
First issue's going to be out, and it's not an April Fool's joke. They were going to have a print version of VW Trends come out quarterly with this issue this month.
That's awesome. Is it only about, I mean, is it just all Volkswagens, or is it just like the Beetlebug?
It's pretty much, it's going all the way back to its roots, and it's the bugs. There's some Type 4s and a few other weird little things in there, but the primary focus is the classic cow look bug.
That's awesome. I mean, that's kind of like a Baja thing, right? Because, I mean, there's a designated class down there for those bugs.
Still have a class 11, and when I was doing VW Trends the first time, there was also the class 5 and class 5 unlimited cars. So there were three classes where you could race a bug-shaped car.
Just a shaped car. It didn't have to be a VW.
Yeah. The unlimited five cars had the Porsche sixes in them and 3 feet of travel even back then and stuff. So it was just a shell. They were real race cars. And then class 11 was a bone stock Beetle. So you had everything. And as the editor, I got to go in all of them. I didn't care to repeat the class 11 and the Baja 500 after the first time, but the other cars, the real race cars, yeah, I'd go back and do it again in a heartbeat. And then that's when I first got out of college, and I had multiple internships, but I hadn't worked at McMullen because McMullen was always second rate to Peterson and the big publishing company. So they had a book in every space. Hot VWs was first. And so McMullen introduced VW Trends. Hot VWs came out with a personal watercraft book, so we launched Splash. And because I was the new guy and didn't have a full-time job, I got to be on the launch of every new book that we did for about 5 years. And unfortunately, including Trends, most of them went the way of the dodo. So funny story, though, at the end of the hall was where the worst magazines and the newest magazines went. So as the newest guy in the company, I got the office furthest down. It was Tom McMullen's old Cougar run. He had two Cougars, and there was the entire building, the offices were put in the length of what had formerly been his Cougar run. Well, the Cougars, you know what cat pee smells like. Well, put that on steroids, and that was that final office had been the slab. So when it rained, it literally peeled the paint off of the walls, and it was horrible. So I didn't know how bad it was. I was working in a magazine and having the time of my life and probably shouldn't have done it. But put up with the toxic waste, worked on VW Trends. The next office over was All About Beer. the editor of All About Beer went in for his third DUI in a week. And so the owner of the company came down to the end of the hall as far as he could, put his mask over his face because he couldn't stand the smell, and said, "Hey, kid, you went to college. You drink beer, right?" "Yes, sir, I do." "All right, well, you're the new editor of All About Beer, and come up front. We got somebody to meet with." So I went up front and met with a guy who was the country opener for Scottish and Newcastle United Brewing. And I got the first case of Newcastle Brown in America handed to me. And my job at that point was do a taste test on these guys. So I was living pretty high on the hog at that point.
Oh, man, that sounds like fun. Newcastle, too. Wow. I haven't had one of those in a long time, but I loved Newcastles for a while. It's definitely kind of an acquired taste.
But it was my favorite of all time at that point. And the fact that they came in with a cover four ad and everything else made everybody in the publishing world happy, too. So I had a great gig for a couple of years. The founder of the magazine was Mike Bozak, and he'd worked at World Color and was our pre-press guy. When he retired, they gave him his magazine back as a farewell present. And he ran that for a couple of years, and I helped him. And then he sold it to some people on the East Coast. And their first thing was, anybody who had anything to do with the old All About Beer is out. We never want to see you. So I didn't quit. I didn't get fired from the best job ever. My position was eliminated because I'd been affiliated with the previous version of All About Beer.
The previous regime, huh?
Yeah. And then I guess I have a track record of that, because the first time that I left Dealer News, I went to work for MPN, and it was owned by AB Publications in Madison, Wisconsin. And I worked there for 5 years and worked my way up from editor to editor-in-chief and publisher, and ran that whole thing, same as I'd done with Dealer News for the previous 13 or 14 years, and had a falling out with the management, was asked to leave. First time I'd ever, other than beer, been fired from a position or had my position eliminated, and I left. They subsequently sold MPN to another group. And that other group came back and recruited me to do what I'd done previously. So I have 2 5-year stints at MPN and now 2 stints at Dealer News, bookending that.
Well, that's kind of crazy that you've been at both twice now. I didn't realize that one.
Yeah. And my former competitor's motorcycle industry is gone. So PSB came out when Joe Delmont and Guido Ebert put it together, and that became our primary competition.
One thing about Dealer News I'd noticed that I didn't also realize is that you're instrumental in helping create the Dealer News Top 100 program.
That was a group effort in the beginning. John Murphy and Don Imdy were the two prior publishers of Dealer News. And Don had just launched his Motorcycle Collector magazine, but he was still consulting with Murphy to get him up to speed, because John had been selling booth space for the Dealer Expo and the consumer events. So as John got up to speed, and he's the one who brought me into interview, we were sitting there. It's like, okay, looks like we got a budget shortfall here in December. What are we going to do? And I said, well, let's figure something out here. And between the three of us, we came out with a top 100 program and a yearbook as a way to generate some advertising. And then after they left the room, I realized, oh, I need to build this top 100 program so that we actually have some content to put in to this yearbook that we're now pre-selling. So it was an interesting run, but the concept caught on. And for 25 years, that was the industry's foremost recognition of retail excellence. And then in 2015, when Advanstar decided to pull the plug on just the Dealer Expo and the magazine, Top 100 stopped at that point. But that's not to say, if I can make a comeback like the Bad Penny, then look for Top 100 to return.
I never understood that. What was the, how did you determine the Top 100? Was it Were there like multiple factors that, you know?
Well, that first year, it was, I had 107 total entries. So that's how the 100 got settled on. I didn't want to throw anybody out. There was a couple that were just so bad, or I knew it wouldn't be in business by the time the Dealer Expo rolled around and we had the yearbook done. So that's how that 100 magic number hit. And then when I was doing it, I thought it was incumbent upon me to know every dealer. So I read through every single submission, and this was back pre-computer days. So they had to mail them in. They had to shoot photos. They had to do all this stuff. So it was a lot of work to enter the contest. I figured we owed it to them to spend as much time reviewing their entries as they did putting them together. And yeah. I took our top sponsors of the yearbook, and we locked everybody in a room for as long as it took to weed through as many entries as we got. And there were some years when you got 300 or 500 entries coming in, that's a lot of work.
Oh man. Yeah.
But
you're like, what did I create?
It helped because by studying that, I knew the big dealers, the small dealers, the best use of space guys, the guys with the most innovative advertising campaign, the people who'd hired somebody from outside the family to put together their package. I mean, you learn a lot from that process, and I'm very thankful for it because even to this day, I see my dealer friends and I can remember their whole history because I had to memorize it going through their entries for 20 years.
Yeah, you have an encyclopedia probably in your mind of all these dealers, and I feel like I have that a little bit with racers for some reason. I think I did, you know, through the years I've done some rider support, and so. But I always enjoyed that kind of studying, like really keeping up on the athletes. And so, you know, it's probably similar. You know, it's kind of interesting and fun to know, you know, how these dealers operate. And so
it's awesome. And it's still awesome to this day. And now I see second and even third generation kids taking over the family business and things like that. And it just or the business is growing from one little store to now they got five stores and things like that. It's just. It's history in the making, and I'm just lucky enough to have a front row seat for it.
Now, I've noticed through the years you're very active and involved in just industry. I mean, obviously because you know it's trade publication, so you're probably more focused on that. But you're also just you're involved in a lot of different initiatives. For example, the National Power Sports Dealer Association, that's a hot thing right now. And then you were also recently elected to the MIC Board of Directors. So tell us a little bit about those. Maybe start with the board of directors, and then we could talk a little bit about the National, you know, Power Sports Dealer Association.
The MIC, at the very beginning, when I first started Dealer News, Don Brown took me under his wing, and he brought me in to the MIC aftermarket committee at that time. And he was also the head of the stats committee. So by default, because I needed to watch the numbers and stuff, all of a sudden, now I'm on two of the MIC committees, literally the first week I'm on the job at Dealer News. And so I've been an active member of the MIC aftermarket committee that whole time. Its role has changed, and it's gone through a number of iterations, but it's still there, and it's still people from the aftermarket to balance the OE max dues paid members' perspective and just make our industry stronger because we are hearing from both sides of the equation. Fast forward to last year, and I got nominated to run for the MIC board. But historically, Eric Anderson had always held the seat, and it's 2-year terms. So every time that I'd been nominated in the previous years, was also the years that Eric was up for re-election and he was always a shoo-in. So they're just cracking that cycle wasn't going to happen until Eric relinquished his seat. And when that happened, then I did get elected. So I don't know if I'll go on quite the run that Eric did, but it's definitely been interesting. And I think that seeing the inside of what that board faces and the achievements they've done and just what's happened that MIC has delivered to our industry since the advent of COVID, it's pretty amazing. It's always easier to badmouth them and be griping about something than it is to be part of the solution. But now, having seen what they've faced and what they've achieved, I am still MIC's biggest fan. And then the one thing that the Motorcycle Industry Council had not done historically was heard the voice of the dealer. And Dealer News being the voice of the power sports industry, well, yeah, but we're the voice of the dealer specifically. We never had a seat at the table other than me trying to represent that constituency. So they did finally open up membership for dealers, but they're not voting members, and they've got a number of restrictions. And because that the dealers weren't being heard, and because every other industry in the world has an association, it seemed kind of strange. National Auto Dealer Association, NADA, they're 100 years old, more than 100 years old. Our industry is more than 100 years old, but we've never had a successful National Dealer Association. There's been a number of tries over the years, and history buffs can go back and Google Ed Limco and see some of that. But now, because of the pandemic, the changes in the business environment, all that, there is a need for the dealers. And MIC has recognized that need, has expanded the role of their dealer advisory council. They just brought in Rick Alcon from RNS in New Mexico as the new head of the dealer advisory council, the MIC. And Rick has addressed the board now. So we are hearing the voice of the dealers at the MIC level. And as amazing as MIC does and thinks, they can't do it all. The dealers need their own association, RVIA, the Marine Industry Retail Association, any of these. There's an association of associations. There is 92,000 plus associations for other industries out there. So I think that there is room for a National Dealer Association. That being said, there's an ad hoc advisory committee put together, but we can't be members of this. Dealers have to impanel their own officers and create their own board. We can hand them over a bunch of tools, but I cannot be a member of the National Dealer Association by the pure fact that I am not a dealer. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens. There's a lot of really sharp businessmen out there and women, and there's a group coming together soon. So sooner than later, we'll see a National Dealer Association in some format being presented.
Yeah, I think I wonder if it's really, you know, the timing was just is finally right for it. You know, I feel like there's definitely been, you know, another paradigm shift in even dealership, you know, owners. I feel like it's more, you know, business oriented, you know, more mega stores, more, you know, multiple franchises. And so I think probably a lot of these dealer owners are a little more, you know, and I don't mean this in a negative way, but they're, you know, they're a little more business savvy. And so they probably would, you know, find value in having a dealer association.
If you look back when I first started the Dealer News in the early 90s, we were at our lowest point in terms of unit sales and as an industry following a recession. And we, I mean, since the ban of the three-wheelers, the mid-80s all the way through 1990, it was decline. There was no bright spots, and we went from 3 to 5 million new units sold to 500,000 new units sold. And then it climbed up, and we went on a 13-year run of double-digit growth. So if you had a pulse, you could succeed as a motorcycle dealer. And then we had the crash and another recession and a shaking out, and all of a sudden it got very difficult to be in the power sports industry of any kind. So then after the crash, we climbed up pre-pandemic and we're flat, about 500,000 units where we'd been back in 1990. We were all the way back to ground zero. And then since the pandemic, with the sale of dirt bikes and certain niches within the power sports industry, like side-by-sides that didn't exist before, now we're a healthy industry once again, but we need to control that growth. We need to pay attention to what we're doing, and we do need better businessmen, and we need an association and representation to protect our rights. There's so many things pending now with the new administration taking over in Washington. We just saw Oceano Dunes get shot down, so the last open section of beach riding on the entire West Coast, except for up Northern Oregon, is gone. We face a lot of issues and challenges, and we need a voice and the dealers to stand together to protect their own individual rights.
I think it's a great thing, great idea, and so hopefully it'll happen this time. So, I mean, with people like you, I think there's a really good chance of it, you know, coming about this time. So I wanted to ask you too, I noticed that, so when you went to college, you and I are both English majors, and I didn't realize that for some reason. I should have known, because you're a good writer and you've been writing for a long time. So I'm curious what some of your favorite classes were, because I noticed you're a language and literature major.
English lit and English language, and also German studies, because I like to drink beer. So when I did get the job at All About Beer, I did have experience. I'd consumed as much or more beer than anybody else had. My roommate and I, though, at the time, we didn't have a lot of money, so once a week we would have import night, and we would get a six-pack of any import beer that we could afford, and we kept tasting notes, just as a joke, and we kept one bottle out of each six-pack. Well, by the time we graduated, there were thousands of bottles stacked floor to ceiling on shelves in our dorm room, and a ream of tasting notes for every single one of those bottles of beer. So I lucked into the All About Beer job, but I'd set that up as a college student.
You're extremely qualified. It sounds to me like.
And a lot of history classes, you can only declare a double major. But because I had so many AP classes in high school and stuff, I didn't take a lot of under division classes, so I could go straight into higher stuff. So I have enough units to qualify as a history major too. But you can't make a job, or you can't make a living as a history major, and you really can't make a living as a German studies major. And even if I could say, would you like fries with that in German? I wasn't going to go the fast food route. So the writing thing worked out pretty well.
What is that? Schweinschnitzel mit Pommes? Right?
Confrites.
Confrites. Oh, yeah. I think I was mixing French and German maybe or something. one of my favorite classes in college, you know, being an English major, was a class, and I think it was called Truth in Nonfiction. And what I loved about that, so for an entire semester, we pretty much just debated what is truth in nonfiction writing. And what was so cool about that to me is when I started out, I was one of those just absolutists where, like, if you're not telling the truth, you know, it's all a lie. And then by the end of it, I was kind of like, so really someone made the argument, you know, is everyone's memory of a moment their truth? Is that their version of the truth? And so it's got me thinking where it's like, you know, the way I remembered an event and the way my mom remembered an event are probably completely different. And so it was an interesting class, you know, like being able to just debate that for hours.
And it makes you think, and that's the thing that we've lost. Journalism is no longer journalism. It's entertainment, and content is based on number of clicks and likes and forwards, not what the truth of the matter is. And there's not fair and balanced reporting on any side of any issue.
Yep.
And again, if you want to go back to school and think about it theoretically, there's not even fair and balanced reporting in that, because your story is always shaped by your experiences and your own two eyes and your perception of that event. And that's going to be different than somebody else's. It'll still be the truth. It's just your truth.
Yep.
So I have an issue with these people that believe the media still, because it's not media, it's entertainment. But there is no Walter Cronkite out there. There is no neutral, fair middle ground. There's no both sides of every story being presented. And I have an issue with that in the real world as well as within the magazine world.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And anymore, it's just sort of like, You're right. It's entertainment. I hadn't really thought about it, you know, in that manner, but you're right, because I read news still all the time, but I kind of take it with a grain of salt, and maybe I'll glean a few things, you know, items from it, but then there'll be a few eye rolls in there too, you know? And so it's like, you know, It's,
but that's what you did learn in that class, is you did learn critical thinking. Yep. So other than learning how to drink beer, I did learn how to learn in college.
Nice.
And that's what you need to take away from that. And that experience is being lost. And that experience is really lost if you're trying to Zoom learn or something like that. It is not the same thing. You have to have educated debate and discussion these issues. You need somebody who is experienced as a professor that can steer you down that path to make these conversations happen. And all of that stuff has been lost. I just saw, and in the old days, there was 20, 30 different major newspaper chains. Now there's two or three. And one of the big three that owns more than 100 newspapers has told their editors and their reporters, you're not going to be paid a salary. You're going to be paid on time spent on page on your story, number of clicks on that, and all of that. So now even an objective journalist has to come up with what's the catchiest headline, what's going to get them to stay on that page, what's going to get them to scroll to the second page below the fold, and all of those things. So they're no longer focused on getting the truth. They're focused on a paycheck by generating clicks and likes on their particular story.
Man, that's actually really disappointing to hear, because that's a slippery slope there. So I hope that's not the case, where people are writing strictly for SEO instead of creatively. And so I feel like that just takes the fun out of creative writing if you're having to write for SEO and clicks and adding extra words in because it'll give you extra, you know, traffic. You know, that's too bad. I hope that's not the case, but I think you're right.
Go back and Google it, and I can't remember if it was Copley or which chain it was, but it just disillusioned me so much that I stopped looking at it. It's like it's true, but it doesn't make it any less palatable.
So how many articles do you think you've written in your career? Had to be a lot.
Well, at one, even early on at McMullen, I was doing Splash, VW Trends, Four Wheel Drive Action, All About Beer, which was bi-monthly, so that was my break in the schedule. And then contributing to Knives Illustrated, American Survival Guide, and Handguns Illustrated. So just in the first couple years of that, there was probably 30 major articles a month that I was doing.
Holy wow.
But I got used to that. I went to work for a newspaper right out of college. And it was only a weekly newspaper, so it wasn't that hard. But I had the police blotter, the obits page, the water district in a rural community. That was an important thing. And the school district, because I was the closest one to understand what was going on with the school thing. So I had my four main beats, plus whatever came up in the newsroom, whoever's the loose reporter has to go cover it. And so that was great training. You don't have time to get writer's block. You don't have the luxury of let me think this through or whatever. It's like you learn your craft, you hone it, and you get that story in. And that was, my editor would chase me on the stories. He would be making the corrections, putting the headline in, the deck, the breakheads, and all of that while I'm literally typing my last paragraph, and then it went out to Linotype. So that kind of environment, you get good or you get into another line of work.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say, because I can't imagine, and I've told my wife this numerous times when I've been, you know, I've done some long form articles for some brands, and, you know, like a piece that you can write for a while, put it away, come back the next day, and maybe it takes you a month to write this thing, you know, like that's kind of my style, but I can't imagine being in a newsroom where you got to smash out a piece of content and you literally have a deadline to where we're going to print with or without you, or we're going with you probably, but I mean, that, it's just, I'm in awe over that. So,
well, and it was great training also because it's a small local newspaper. So everybody in town reads it. All the kids you went to school with, all your teachers, everybody that you've ever known your whole life gets it. So you do not misspell somebody's name. you don't make a mistake and you know where the skeletons are. It's like, yeah, don't touch that third rail because that's just the town secret. Here's what we focus on, sort of thing. So it disillusioned me that, like, it wasn't just pure journalism, but it also conditioned me and trained me that it's like, you can still tell the truth and you can do the best job possible, even if it's the opening of a local ice cream parlor.
Yep. Well, one last question for you from your experiences in the industry is, what's probably one of your favorite press events that you've ever been invited to, or, you know, like an exotic place you've been, whether it's a trade show or, you know, new bike reveal or some other media event you've been invited to?
Well, I will say that Dealer News has been the best job ever. And Dealer Expo was the greatest single event there was. And I got to be right in the heart of that for every year. Even when I wasn't on staff, I was still an exhibitor or covering it for another magazine or something. So for 35 years, I got to be at the best event every year. And I got to see all of the dealers whose submissions I'd memorized over the years and stuff. So it was the greatest gathering of friends and like-minded individuals that could ever imagine. So that was the best. But individual trips, maybe the first time that KTM took its dealers to the factory in Austria, that was pretty spectacular. And a lot of these small KTM dealers who'd been through the bankruptcy and stuff, they'd never even left their own county, let alone left the country. So they got to go see the factory and do some amazing things. Salzburg, University of Redlands has an extension there on a campus in Salzburg. And my roommate and all my German studies compadres went to the semester abroad. I never got to do that. So I went back with the KTM group. I got off the airplane and I went straight to the local at the Augustiner brew pub. I sat down and I looked, and carved into the rafter above where I was sitting was my roommate's name. And I was in his seat just by default. That it worked out that way. And that was the trip where after touring the factory, all the dealers were taken out to a big open field. And it's where Julie Andrews comes over the hill, and it's the Sound of Music. And so you've got this virgin grass track, and you've got all these brand new KTMs lined up, and gas and fresh knobs, and they turn the dealers loose on it. And Malcolm had said he was never going to ride again after getting hurt the first time. He saw this, and I have pictures of him wearing his Hawaiian shirt, borrowed helmet, and ripping it up on a virgin grass track with the typical Malcolm smile ear to ear and having the time of his life. So as far as junkets go, that one's going to stand out for a long time.
Sounds like a blast. And you just reminded me when you mentioned Salzburg, like I think that's pretty close to Munich, if I'm not mistaken, from my time when I lived over there. But I was able to go to that Munich trade show a couple times, and man, talk about a fun time, you know, like during Oktoberfest and, yeah.
Well, that and the Deutsches Museum there in Munich has, it's a transportation museum, but it's got a great motorcycle collection down in the sub-basement. Most people don't even go down there. The original Wolf brand and Hilda Miller first production motorcycle in the world is down there. All these things are in this great museum sitting next to the river, and it just, nobody goes to it. So every year that I went to the Intermote show and its predecessor, IFMA, whatever it was, I always made it a point to spend an extra day just to go back to the museum and see that stuff and drink beer for another day at Oktoberfest.
Yeah, and I have to say, like, for me, like, that, the Hefeweizen over there, like, is, I still, to this day, like, it was some of the best beer I've ever had. And it seemed to be a little kind, you know, it was a little kinder on you for the hangovers too. And I don't know if that's like the German purity laws or whatever. I think that they have, but
yeah, the Reinheitsgebot limits the stuff that you can put in. So we can go back to my beer days, and I can tell you that the Beechwood age process that Anheuser-Busch used, that was throwing wood chips soaked in formaldehyde into a metallic vat And that's what gave it its beechwood aging. So that stuff never flies with the local German beers. And then in Cologne, where the show is now, same thing. The local style is a Kolsch. And there's a bar on, you go in, there's four bars on four corners, all serving Kolsch, all made by the same standards as the Reinheitsgebot purity laws dictate, and totally different beers. And it's amazing.
Yeah, don't they have like special glasses they drink them in too?
Oh yeah, a Kolsch glass is a tall, thin chimney style glass.
Yep.
And you can only, if you're proper German, you only drink a Kolsch out of a Kolsch glass. you would never put that into a Stein or something. That just, oh no, that's what ugly Americans do.
That's so funny. I mean, it makes me just think of, you know, like everything here is like, you know, organic this, that, you know, and they've been doing it for hundreds of years. And before, you know, they probably don't even think about it that way. It's just like, no, we're going to make it with the least ingredients we can and make it pure. You know, it's pretty interesting.
I have had a great career drinking beer and playing with motorcycles and hanging out with the best people in the world. So I may never get rich, but if I did win the lottery, what would I do? I'd do what I get paid to do now.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that'd probably be overrated. You know, I think of people that win the lottery in some cases end up miserable. So
I'm willing to risk it.
Yeah. Well, Robin, it's been a pleasure talking with you today. Always fun to talk with you and share stories. And is there anything else you want to share with us before I wrap up this episode?
Well, I'm sorry for boring everybody for an hour. Hopefully you can edit this down to a 5-second spot and call it good.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, I'm looking forward to, you know, what's coming down the road from you guys at Dealer News and you know, seeing if this, you know, dealer association comes about. And so hope to have you back on again soon, and we can, you know, see how things have changed maybe in you know, a few months down the road.
Well, I will say keep an eye out for the next issue. I keep wondering what we can do for an encore, but the next issue is going to be very special. We have an interview with Mary McGee and some other really cool stuff coming. Hector Cadmatori is going to do the illustration of Mary for the cover. So I can't wait to see what we're going to do.
Sounds awesome. Before I wrap this up, I'd like to just say thanks to everybody out there who's dropped me a message, whether it's text, email, or call, and just really appreciate the words of encouragement and people that have helped me with technical knowledge and ideas for show guests. You know, it's super appreciated, and I'm having a good time with this podcast. So look for more episodes coming soon. So that's about it for this episode. Remember to be kind to each other, listen to good music, enjoy life on two wheels, and keep the buzz rolling. Thanks for listening. Hey there, two-wheel enthusiasts. It's Dale Spangler, host of the Dirt Buzz. Before we start this episode, I wanted to ask if you would consider becoming a patron of the Dirt Buzz. For as little as $3 per month, you'll help keep the buzz rolling by helping me cover costs associated with producing and hosting this show, such as recording software and equipment, hosting fees, and other administrative costs. The Buzz is just getting started, and with your support, I'll continue to bring you weekly episodes featuring the many fascinating people in the world of power sports and the sport of motorcycling as a whole. Head over to patreon.com/dirtbuzz right now, or look for the Support the Show link at the bottom of each podcast episode description. Once again, thank you for listening and supporting the Dirt Buzz. Enjoy this episode.